This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Clear that a ban or moratorium on social media by kids, who we do need to protect, can be an important element, but it can't be the only one. It could be an important layer, but it has to be seen as that and not as the answer to everything. Online harms don't end as soon as you turn 15 or 16 or 17. We have some work to do, frankly, if we want to get it right. The politics, perhaps, of it are convenient, but the policy has to be right as well.
We're in lots of discussions about how to make sure that we're protecting kids. And there's discussions about banning social media, but there's lots of issues that we've got to come to ground on. Age verification, how to do it, what the scope and scale.
The question of a children's ban for social media and AI chatbots has emerged as one of the most talked about digital policy issues in recent memory. Provincial premiers, the Liberal convention, the culture minister, and the media have all jumped on board. Indeed, just last week, I appeared before a Senate committee on AI regulation in which one senator asked all those assembled who supported the ban. Almost all hands went up. Mine didn't. And I suspect my guest this week wouldn't have raised her hand either. Dr. Sarah Grimes has been working on children's rights and digital policy for over 20 years, the Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy, and a full professor in the Department of Art History and Communication Studies at McGill University. She brings a unique perspective to the issue as someone who has brought a children's rights perspective to issues such as social media regulation and age verification technologies. She joins me on the podcast to discuss her work and perspectives on the hot digital issue of the moment. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you've come on. You've been working on children's rights and digital policy for many, many years now. And as you know, and so listeners will know, what sparked my interest and my attention was some analysis that you did just last month on an Angus Reid poll that in many ways has been driving at least some of the political conversation around banning social media for kids in Canada. We're now seeing this happen at the provincial level, discussion at the federal level. And the headline finding from that poll was that 75% of Canadians support a full ban on social media for kids that are 16 and under. You went into the data itself. You looked at the cross tabs, and your explainer on this suggests that that number doesn't really tell the whole story. So can you get us started by telling us what you found and what you think the gap might be between what the data actually shows and now how it's being used at the political or media level?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's always the case when we're reporting on polls, we kind of combine categories to be able to simplify the message. So it's not against Angus Reid specifically that they did this, but the way that it's being used and ignoring the nuance, it's important to look at what the poll results actually said. So we're looking at just right off the bat, the 75% of Canadians support a full ban on social media. This is a combination of people who like strongly support as well as people who just support. So we're ostensibly including, you know, any level of support just to get to that 75%. When we look at parents, support decreases significantly. And when we look at parents whose oldest child is between 13 and 15 years, so the group that are most likely to be impacted by a possible ban, because these are the ages that would be banned. And this is where a larger percentage of kids are actually using social media. The five-year-olds are rarely using social media. So that doesn't matter as much. It's really this sweet spot of 13 to 15. And among them, only 37% strongly supported a full ban. So, and this was a kind of interesting thing. Also, 77% of the parents in that category had children who were already using social media. So I'm looking at, 77% of them have kids who are using social media who are in that age group. Only 37% strongly support a ban. Like we're obviously there's some overlap between those two groups, but this is an interesting kind of detail. There's a lot of interesting kind of like nuances when we look at that. But one of the things that really stands out is that of all the various responses to social media concerns and possible harms that were presented in the poll, across all of the poll respondents, a full ban was actually the least popular option. So there were other options presented, ban certain apps only, and they went down and, you know, named a bunch of the most popular ones, requiring parental consent, sending in-app usage reports, having mandatory time limits for people of different ages. And all of those other options actually had more support. So the most popular was to ban certain apps only, which I thought was really interesting. And the ones that they're naming are things like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, where we've already seen so many news stories about not only their own, research, unauthorized research on young people, and the whistleblowers who've come out about some of the really awful stuff that they've done with people's data. But they're also at the center of a number of lawsuits, in the States and other actions in other countries. So that kind of, it's not the same thing to say this particular company is known, or we suspect heavily that they're doing things that are not ethical, let's ban them, versus let's ban all of social media, which, who knows what that would even include. The other thing that I just want to mention before we move on is, the options that were presented did not include other forms of targeted regulation. So they basically just included bans of some kind, and then the same parental mediation tactics that are already, in practice, and possibly making those more robust. I'm not really sure how that would come into play, requiring parental consent for younger people to join social media. These are possibilities that are already in play in different places, but at no point was bringing in requiring robust content moderation, or forbidding companies from using persuasive design on young users, or creating stronger reporting and cooperation with law enforcement around illegal activities. None of those things were presented as possibilities. So the poll itself was heavily slanted towards parental responses and bans. And even so, the majority of the respondents said parents, not governments, should be primarily responsible for regulating teens' social media use. So it's not the home run, revelatory poll that everyone's treating it as. And I don't think that a full ban actually has as much support as we're being led to believe.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And of course, it suggests that, those that are pushing so hard for it may run into some real political risk that they just don't think is there should something like this be implemented. The other thing that I found from your work that was really interesting about the poll, I mean, that data, some of it's pretty stunning to hear what lies beneath the headline. But beyond that, it's a large poll. They polled thousands of people, but none of them were under 18. In other words, no one who was actually going to be directly affected by this was actually asked what they think. Now, I know that you've done work around this issue of youth exclusion from policy debates. Can you talk a bit about what can get lost when you make policy this way, where kids aren't included in policies that directly affect them? And what happens when you start asking kids about what do they think about some of these issues?
Yeah, so I have to start by just pointing out that this is actually a fundamental part of children's rights. It's Article 12. We're supposed to ensure that children who are capable of expressing views on, things that are going to impact them are consulted, and that their views are given weight, in accordance with their age and maturity. But the fact that not even teens were included in the poll is really telling here. And younger children have a lot to say about these issues as well, and would also be impacted. So from a real children's rights perspective, we are supposed to bring children into these conversations when we're making, decisions that are going to impact them, when we're making decisions about their lives. So right off the bat, this is a fundamental right that we're supposed to uphold. We've signed on as a signatory state in Canada to the Convention of the Rights of the Child, and this is something that we've committed to doing. So I'll put that aside for a second. really, you know, at the more practical kind of everyday level, children have the firsthand experience that is really what we need to consult with and base our policymaking decisions on when it comes to regulating their experiences in interactions with the digital environment. Now, I'm not saying that it would be based solely on the things that they're doing, but having a deeper and firsthand experience understanding of what it is they're encountering, what their own concerns are, what they've tried. Because it's not as if children, and especially when we're dealing with older children and adolescents, it's not like they've not tried all kinds of different strategies and tried blocking people or tried reporting people or, you know, tried reading privacy policies and made their way partway through before they realized it was written in legalese made to not be understandable to them. And they can see the things that are actually working and not working. I think that it's also a way of encountering, it's not that it's not a complicated experience, but it's a experience that includes both benefits and harms. So, and risks, both hopes and things and opportunities that aren't being met, as well as things that they're worried about and risks that they want to avoid, or risks that they would like to have taken away from their online experience. I think that when we talk to them and you spend time talking to them about their experiences, you can also see that they can also have quite a lot of insight and good ideas about policy. It's not beyond kids to talk about these things. Even kids as young as 5 and 6 have like pretty sophisticated understandings of intellectual property ownership and privacy rights. If you take the time to listen and you understand the words that they're using to describe these concepts. When we spend time with kids, we can understand that things like a ban or even having screen time limits do very little to actually mitigate the things that they are worried about, the things that they're encountering that they consider harmful and dangerous, or even just unpleasant or unethical, as well as the reasons why they continue to use those spaces despite having encountered that type of thing, because of the good things, the being able to talk to friends from school, the learning, huge amounts of learning and engagement with culture that happen in those spaces. And to be able to understand how those things happen together, I think lends itself much better to creating policies that are more nuanced and are more balanced in terms of like an understanding of what's actually going on. Kids aren't just victims of the digital realm. They're creators, they're, you know, participants, they're social butterflies. They have a lot of other things that are going on there. And I can say these things to people and I can communicate that in my research, but it's nothing compared to actually having kids be part of the consultation process.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it highlights at least one disconnect, but it feels like this debate as a whole, in many respects, there's just this ongoing disconnect between the political realm that it feels of somehow a switch over the last month or two has been hit, and all of a sudden we are just racing towards this policy. And as you say, the kids, the survey data, which isn't really being addressed in sort of the at a more granular level, and then the research community that has been working on many of these issues for many, many years, and at best has a much more nuanced take on the impact of social media and what will work. You know, you have some thoughts about how we can address some of this disconnect that seems to exist right now with this rush towards moving ahead, headline grabbing as it may be, and certainly what many on the evidentiary side have been talking about with respect to addressing some of these concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's going on right now is sort of a perfect storm of converging strong feelings. So like people are fed up. Parents are fed up. Kids are fed up. There's all this stuff happening. We're hearing a lot about it. You know, we're encountering just constant privacy grabs, privacy infringements on every single app, all these notifications. It's, you know, it's not a tenable situation. People feel that their rights are being infringed on. They feel that their well-being is being compromised. by a lot of decisions and design features that have become increasingly prominent. Next, you have, it's kind of like this knight in shining armor, bestseller, popular nonfiction that, you know, comes into the fray and everyone's citing it, The Anxious Generation. So many people have read it. There's all these very loud and visible advocacy groups like Unplug Canada that are, you know, using this as kind of like a manual for how to bring in change and bring in regulation. The book claims that there's this like very real empirical evidence that social media causes this, you know, an array of harms. It's an ever-growing array of harms. More and more harms keep getting tacked on to this argument, and they're scary. It's super scary. It's the worst case scenarios. It's the worst things that have happened. Grabbing it from the headlines, grabbing it from, you know, the worst thing you've ever heard from your neighbor, you know, and really tapping into our fears. And even for people who haven't experienced it firsthand, including children who haven't experienced it firsthand, who are hearing this rhetoric, you know, it's terrifying. There are people out there and this is happening to them. So it seems to be part of what's actually happening because it sounds like science and it also sounds morally right. And it also sounds like it's an answer to these brewing kind of like larger discontent and concerns that all of us do share. When experts push back, it's always in the way that we do, right? As academics, it's, you know, it's correlation, not causation, or the science is being overgeneralized. And that sounds like nothing. That it does nothing to dissuade and dispel anyone's convictions. It sounds like semantics. It sounds like a tiny matter of nuance when really what we're talking about, I'm going to say it, it's misinformation. We're being bombarded with a disinformation campaign that does draw on real studies and it does draw on real findings to package together and made to sound like something that it's not. So these things combine, and it really seems, I think, that bringing in something like a media ban is low-hanging fruit. You know, you have a number of governments who have tried previously to bring in maybe more nuanced legislation, and it took a really long time, and it didn't pass. And this seems like there's a lot of momentum, and there's these really high-profile groups that are pushing for it and behind it. And, you know, it's also super easy because it's not only something that there's already some advocates for, but it requires basically zero change on the part of the government. They don't have to really do much. And the companies also don't have to do much apart from introducing a layer of age gates that will collect a ton more data for social media and AI companies and collect a ton more data from children in ways that they are currently not supposed to be collecting them in the name of age assurance and age verification. And, you know, and it the whole thing will make it seem like politicians acted really decisively because they did something so radical, but really it's parents and children who will have to be the ones who make all the changes. You know, they're the ones who are gonna have to change behaviors. So how do we bridge this disconnect? I think for those of us who are actually in this field, who are actually, you know, engaging with children, with teens, who have the firsthand knowledge, who have the research knowledge, who have the expertise, who have the sense, the inkling that this rhetoric is not apt, we need to fight back more forcefully. And I know that that's probably, that's not exactly like easing the disconnect. But I think that the disconnect really is because it seems so one-sided right now, and it's absolutely not. And we need to give a stronger voice to all of the many of us who know that this is not the right way forward.
Okay. That's really hard. That's really heartening and a great call to action, I think. You know, you talk about sort of the reality behind the rhetoric or the misinformation. The reality is playing out in at least one place, and that's Australia, where they have implemented this. I had Lisa Given on the podcast a number of months ago before we even started having data, and she discussed how, you know, they flicked the switch and suddenly the ban was in effect and parents were waking up one day saying, holy smokes, what just happened here? There's real concerns. They've got real concerns with how this was being implemented. And sure enough, several months later, we started getting data from the eSafety Commissioner. There's another poll from the Molly Rose Foundation, both of which suggest that, frankly, it's not really working. That in fact, by far the majority of kids under 16 who had social media accounts before still have them now. So, you know, what's your read on that experience? Is it consistent with how I just described it? And, you know, what does that tell us about what's likely to happen here? Should we move ahead with something similar?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like all of these experts who wrote op-eds and testified, you know, and tried to share all of their concerns with the ban. Like, if they're out there saying, I told you so right now, like, I wouldn't blame them. Although I would also caution, we're only a couple of months in. So, you know, it takes a long time for this type of sea change to actually, you know, take place and implement and have people abide by it. So I guess, you know, the corporations are bringing in all of these tech fixes that were, you know, hyped and definitely were never going to be as robust as the companies who designed them promised they would be. That's not a surprise, but they'll work out their kinks and fixes. And, you know, as they're using these technologies, I can only assume that they're developing a more robust, you know, system on all these individual fronts that could work better in the future. But the problem is that the young people are just kind of using VPNs and going to other sites and using other platforms. And the main problem is this was never the problem in the first place. So, you know, I was on a different interview a couple of months ago about the age ban, where they asked me, like, how will we know if it works? And it kind of felt like we'll never know, because the age ban was supposed to bring about this like improvement in children's mental health and it, you know, a reduction in cyberbullying and all of these amazing things. It was supposed to solve all of the problems. And of course, it's not going to. And so we're not going to see those improvements, and we're not seeing them now. What we're seeing and what we're focusing on right now is compliance rates. I want to hear about the mental health benefits. Like, tell me about those things. Because that was the reason that this very dramatic, radical, like sweeping, like, let's take away these platforms that kids like from them because they're to blame for everything. Let's see some of those results. And we're not seeing those either. So I will hesitate to draw like firm conclusions. These are my suspicions until a few more months have passed and we can see what the rebound effect is. We can see what happens when so many of the young people and parents who did comply realize that there's zero repercussion to not complying. You know, when these alternative platforms become popular enough that more and more kids are using them, they're unregulated, they're not, you know, doing anything special in terms of design changes and increased content moderation. So I don't know. It's a bit of a mess, I would say.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair characterization. You know, you mentioned age gating a moment ago, and that has been a pretty consistent issue that I've talked about on my podcast, primarily for at least a couple of years with respect to adult content and Senator Julie Melville Deschaine's bill, S210, then S209. But now, of course, it's become much broader, focusing on this issue as well. And Ian Goldberg, a Canada Research Chair at the University of Waterloo, was on the podcast recently. He was focusing on the technical and privacy-related concerns. And there are hundreds of scientists that have signed a public letter expressing real concerns about what this technology might mean. But you've looked at this issue from a different angle. You know, you had a submission back in 2024 to the Office of the Privacy Commissioner on age assurance, and you argued from a children's rights framework, you know, naturally enough, given your work. And it was grounded in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Can you talk a bit about what using that lens rather than the privacy and security lens, which tends to be the first stop for people talking about age assurance or age gating, you know, what's being missed by the privacy and security perspective that looking at this through the perspective that you brought really brings?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Yeah, it was an opportunity to go back and look at the submission that we had written as well, which, yeah, as you mentioned, is 2 years ago now. So it's been a while, but it still holds. And it was kind of interesting to see the OPC put out their, you know, finally kind of like their decisions about what the guidelines are going to be for age assurance. So yeah, it's definitely back on the radar now because it's such a huge part of social media ban discourse. Like, how will these be implemented? For thinking about it from a children's rights perspective is one way of kind of bringing in some of the nuance that children themselves would bring if we were consulting with them on what the benefits and problems are, because it requires us to consider multiple angles. Like, when we're thinking about taking away access, it can't be reduced to just safety versus privacy or security versus privacy. We also have to consider things like, do they have the right to information? They do. The right to education, the right to participate in culture. How are these things being weighed? How are they being considered? How are they being incorporated? You know, it's not an on-off switch where we give up our names or our faces in exchange for being safe. There's a ripple effect of other things that are involved when we allow or don't allow someone to participate in an activity or to access a technology. So right from the get-go, this requirement of balancing rights, and it's not that this is something that can really feasibly be ever perfectly achieved, but putting this as the tenet, like the principle that we're working towards, makes us think about these other things. What we included as one of the main recommendations that kind of reflects part of this, just a small part of this, is who's deciding whether things are age appropriate or not is really an important question. These issues have come up so far in kind of like these two broad categories. They've come up in adult content. So, you know, preventing underage people from viewing and consuming and participating in adult content, as well as now social media bans, which are being conceived of as adult only spaces, I guess, or it, which is so ironic given their origins and, you know, that teens were always the main kind of instigators and content creators on things like TikTok. But I digress, we'll put that aside. But for everything else, we haven't even had a conversation about it. And so what we're seeing is this kind of widespread adoption of, oh, we will be compliant. We're going to respect kids' rights by keeping them safe, or we'll keep kids safe by barring them from our space, using age assurance to do that without any consideration of, like, is this actually an inappropriate space for kids to be? What are the rights that we're completely sacrificing, you know, in the name of a prioritization of safety, really, again, defined based on worst case scenario fears, or just like wanting to not be liable or wanting to avoid having to put in the extra effort to have kids on the site or on the platform. Another part of that is, of course, that privacy is a cross-cutting right. And this is in the UN General Comment 25 on children's rights and digital environment. And we talk about this as well. Privacy isn't just about your name and your face. It's also about the things that you do and the things that you say, and having these things collected and kind of used against you in all of these various ways is a really fundamental risk that is undervalued and kind of underconsidered when we talk about age assurance. I was listening to the interview that you had with Ian Goldberg earlier this week, and I was thinking about the age inference kind of technologies, behavioral tracking, reading every text message, just kind of like, you know, endless commercial surveillance in the name of safety. I mentioned that earlier. You know, this is something that a lot of companies have been doing already. I mean, a lot of these kids games, a lot of these platforms, really, this is what they're doing. They're collecting all this data and they're, you know, packaging it up and selling it to advertisers or using it to train AI models now. And, you know, it's incredibly valuable, this data. It's not just about your name and your face, but what does an 8-year-old do, you know, or what does a under 16-year-old or a 16 to 18-year-old talk about? These are important things when you're trying to train an AI model that will track them, but also to sell stuff to them, or also to manipulate them and send them propaganda. So there's a lot of different uses of this data that we're handing over to these tools, these systems, and these companies in the name of safety that we really need to consider? Like, what are the larger repercussions of that?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. No, that certainly the what takes place in the age estimation context, often sold as, well, you're concerned about handing over your identification and security breaches. We can just figure out how old you are. But it turns out figuring out how old you are brings in a whole next level of surveillance of users in the name of trying to give them better privacy. It's hard to reconcile how that technology makes anything better. You know, one thing people have argued would make things better is not to move forward with using something premised on age assurance, but rather incorporating design codes, appropriate design that really meets the needs and better addresses some of the kinds of harms or concerns that arise. We've seen that attempts at implementing that in places in the UK and in California. Can you talk about what that might look like and why that might be a better approach in terms of trying to deal with some of the concerns that arise in this online environment?
Yeah, I love this approach. I just spent like the past 5 years studying age-appropriate design and the different ways that it's been brought into policy to design standards in different, you know, sectors of the children's industries, and what kids think about the principles in all kinds of direct and indirect ways. And you know, I think that this should be our template. Like we should build it out and customize it to the Canadian context. And it should be built out beyond privacy alone. I mean, the children's code, the age appropriate design code in the UK is the children's code is, you know, was formulated by the ICO, the Information Commission. So it's a privacy first set of guidance or guidelines. But it has like the right focus. It's focused on service providers. It's focused on companies and the things that companies are doing. Like the tangible steps that they're going through as they bring in users, including children, as they collect data from them, as they deliver services to them, you know, and as they kind of like navigate through all the different types of potential harms as well as benefits that users will encounter in their spaces. And this sounds really complicated, and it is. There's like 15 principles, and this is like focused on privacy. But it, you know, there's a duty of care. There's a requirement of protecting and safeguarding children's data, even if they're on sites that they're not supposed to be on or using services that they're not supposed to be using. There's a real child data protection first. That is not a safety first. It's a child protection of their data rights and their privacy rights first. And I can see how this could be built out into a larger framework for thinking about rights first, where the companies are the ones who are on the hook for curbing the potentially harmful, you know, I call them behaviors. They're not, they're practices, they're design features. Like you said, you know, persuasive design, compelling, continued use, you know, beyond the time when, right as the person's about to log off, then that's when the prize arises or the notification arises. Like these are persuasive design tactics. Many people study them. We know about them. You know, they can be connected to dark patterns. Why is that allowed? We're associating it right now with, you know, social media potentially. I've seen these things in games as well. I think the point is when you look at industry practices, they transport from one genre to the other. A new technology emerges and all of a sudden you have like embedded advertising again. And it looks a bit different, but it's experienced similarly. And it draws on the same principles of the data collection, of being able to deliver, of having like this always on sort of access to users, and not an easy way to bypass or turn those features off. So I think focusing on what is it about the tech world, the digital world, that is most risky, that is the most likely to introduce harms, and how can we require companies to not target those things to children? Like this is the way. It's too bad that it hasn't had more interest and uptake. But of course, the companies really fight against it because it requires a lot of changes internally. It's a lot of work. But I'll tell you, that even seeing, so studying in this space, delivery of advertisements in kids' apps before and after the implementation of the children's code back in, I guess it was 2021, we saw a difference, and it wasn't even applicable to us, but the companies were changing so much about their delivery of advertisements and content to comply and conform to the children's code that it had a ripple effect in Canada, where all of a sudden children in Canada and Ontario and Quebec anyway were no longer seeing like R-rated, you know, movie ads as they opened up their little Sunshine Bunnies app to play, you know, an alphabet game. They were no longer seeing these completely inappropriate apps, and it coincided so directly with the implementation of the children's code. So they can do it. They just don't have to. So, you know, we have to make them.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to see how you can see those tangible results. You know, some kind of regulation can have real world effects. And it's interesting to see how that played out. Now, I know your research, especially as part of your children and age appropriate game design project, has run focus groups with kids that are between the ages, I believe, of 6 to 12, and I know that it took place in Ontario and Quebec, about how they think about age appropriateness. Can you talk a bit about what kids actually say when you ask them about some of these issues, and then how do we translate that into something that policymakers can make use of?
They had so much to say. One of the things that they have asked me to tell people about what they said is to make sure that grownups know that, like, there's no one size fits all that tracks with numeric age. And this was something that came up again and again, and this was across all the groups in both provinces. It wasn't really about, I am 9, and so now I can handle chatting with strangers. It had much more to do with like the personal maturity, if they knew strategies for what to do if something, you know, if the person said something bad to them, if they had parents that they could talk to, if there was an easy way to turn it off. So it was so much more complicated than that. But the thing that they were really concerned about, kind of across the different ages, was that they often get typecast kind of like based on their numeric age. And it doesn't really reflect their literacy levels, their digital literacy levels. It doesn't really reflect their personal capacities. Some of the older kids want to be able to turn off some features that, you know, were just on automatically for them. And others, you know, were younger and were like, I'm worried I'm getting closed out from all of these movies that I can't watch on Netflix anymore, but these are my favorite movies. And now I can't watch them because I have the kid account and they're not available for me. And it doesn't line up with my personal experience or what we're allowed to do in my house. So it had to do with like really problematizing the age in age appropriate. And this is something that other experts who are like looking at age appropriate design and other frameworks have also been emphasizing. It's not like numeric age is actually a really bad kind of like indicator of a person's capacities, of a person's, like, you know, resources, how much they know and don't know, and how much they can handle or not handle. So it needs to be more nuanced. One of the other things that I'll just mention, because it's this podcast, I've been talking to kids in this age group since 2001, 2002. And in the early years of the internet, younger children had like a lot of like generous feelings about the corporations that made their games and platforms and devices. This is no longer the case. This is no longer the case. And even children as old as 6 have a pretty clear perspective on data being collected by companies and feeling like a lot of companies are spying on them. The demand for better privacy protection is palpable. And it is shared. Even for kids who don't want to lose access to their stuff and you don't want anything to change, if that means that they get banned from it, even they were like, well, except for, you know, some of this, like, I don't think they always have to know where I am and who I am all the time. So these are like the two key findings that I'll share today.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. You know, there's been this tendency to think that as kids grow up online, that privacy might they might just accept that part of the bargain is that you give away some of your privacy. And it's notable that you're saying they're well aware of what that bargain looks like, and they're not really happy with the trade that's taking place. And so it falls to policymakers to try to address it. I just want to hit on two quick things before we wrap. One, you mentioned that this transition and some of these issues cut across different technologies. New tech comes along and some of the same issues recur. We're seeing that play out on the very issue we're talking about, because what started with adult content, let's say, and then gravitated to social media is now also gravitating towards AI, in particular AI chatbots. Do you have some thoughts about how some of the same kinds of concerns that you've been raising in the context, especially of social media, might apply within AI and the use of AI chatbots?
Yes. I mean, so much about the discourse around AI chatbots and kids really smells like a moral panic, like a media panic. They're transposing, one horrible event and then bringing it down to a kid level and, assuming that all of the kids are using these things in these really unhealthy ways. The data is still emerging. The data is really new. And, a vast majority of these tools like ChatGPT, if you consider that a chatbot, I'm not even sure what they mean by that category, actually, came out already with age bans, like not necessarily well implemented, but already were forbidding kids under the age of 13 or even under the age of 18 from participating in the terms of service. I think that we need to stop having these knee-jerk reactions where the only solution to every problem is to exclude children. This is not going to help create the information workers of tomorrow. I know that that's a big concern for everybody, actually. I'm making fun of the language use there, but of course we want our children to be digitally and AI literate. And we want them to be able to use these tools. And a key way of using tools is to be able to play around and create. And some of the tools are amazing, and they can be amazing. And with the right scaffolding and the right literacy program, we should have like a national effort to make sure that kids are informed and educated and learn how to use these tools properly. And I do think that there should be safeguards for children, but to cut them out automatically right off the bat, it just seems like a panic. It just seems like a technophobic panic.
Okay. You may have answered this question already. I mean, because the answer you just gave is perfect to the question I was going to wrap with, which was that, we've got the federal government moving ahead. Frankly, as we record this week, we had the culture minister, Mark Miller, say that the government has no choice, that it has to do something on some of these issues. The provinces are rushing ahead. So it does feel like there's a real possibility that we're going to see something that is based on the ban with age verification model in some manner. If you had the opportunity, and hopefully you do, to speak to policymakers or politicians, what's the takeaway from the work that you've been doing, as you say, for more than two decades on all of this, that they need to be thinking about as they grapple with these issues?
Yeah. Social media is such a poorly defined category. It's such an array of forums and interactions and cultural experiences. And like a not insignificant percentage of Canadians get their literal news through social media, which the government knows because of the whole tax, event. And it includes safety concerns, of course, and it also raises privacy concerns, and it also raises identity and cultural heritage concerns and access and literacy concerns. And I don't think that this kind of multiplicity is even on the radar right now. I think that we're dealing with a group of policymakers and experts and advisory board who were initially working on the Online Harms Act, who are really focused on online safety and are now being kind of transported into the realm of social media bans. And when you're coming at it from that perspective, of course, you're going to focus only on risks and harms. That kind of makes sense. That's the milieu out of which, you're attacking it. But it's not really what's needed for this assortment of questions. It's definitely not what kids need and what parents need. It's not what teachers need. And it's not what society needs to only focus on that aspect of it in such a narrow way. Especially, we're not actually tackling the actual risks. We're tackling one small possible manifestation of them, and we're ignoring way too much. There's too much that's not being considered and included here. The places that kids will go instead, the kids who won't have alternative places to go. There's just so much more. I would love to just request. I will plead and beg for a pause and maybe the bringing together of a panel of experts who have expertise in adolescent behavior and culture and some social workers and some educators and like some young people to talk about what this actually is and what are the actual things that they'd like to see dealt with. Because I bet you, informed opinion from many years of research, it's more focused on specific design features and commercial practices than it is on a loose category of, you know, things that kind of look like each other on the internet. And it's not too late to do that. There's no rush, really. Like, it doesn't have to be out by June. It has to happen immediately, but panels of experts can be drawn together very, very quickly. It doesn't have to transport over a bunch of cybersecurity people who are all of those people are excellent, but are they the right people for this job? I don't see it.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully someone's listening, because I think I give that fabulous advice throughout. Really, this whole conversation really highlights what happens when you inject actual experience and research expertise into an issue that, as you suggest, has in many ways been dominated by people who have real expertise, but not necessarily on this issue. And helps explain a large part of the disconnect. So, thank you for taking the time to join the podcast. Thank you thank you so much for all the work that you do on these issues.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbytes@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBytesPod or follow Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.